Hello there, and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. In this episode, Unmasking Dyscalculia, we're going to embark on a journey of discovering and empowerment alongside our special guest, Kat Edel, co-founder of the Dyscalculia Network. Unmasking Dyscalculia is going to dive deep into the intricate layers of this often overlooked neurodiversity. We're going to shed some light on its lifelong impacts and the pressing need for increasing awareness and understanding. Join me as we navigate through the challenges faced by individuals with dyscalculia and explore the empowering strategies and support systems that can transform lives. Before I dive in, this episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials is a team of advanced degree special educators aiming to bridge learning gaps through dyslexia intervention, strategic writing instruction, and executive function support. Visit the link in the show notes for more information on how Learning Essentials can support your students' educational journey. Huge favor to ask, don't forget to hit that like, follow, or share button. It means the world to me. Also, it helps us continue that conversation and support. And find us over at Learning Essentials on Instagram. Stay tuned as we uncover the hidden struggles, celebrate the strengths, and build a more inclusive world together as we dive into our newest episode, Unmasking Dyscalculia. Hello and welcome, Kat. I'm so happy that you could join us today and bring some insight on dyscalculia. So thank you for joining us.
Lovely to be here.
Yes, please. Let's go ahead and can you just share a little bit about who you are in the world of dyscalculia?
I'm one of the co-founders of the Dyscalculia Network, which is a not-for-profit based in England, which works to support people with dyscalculia and those who support them. So both adults with dyscalculia, children with dyscalculia, educators and employers.
Yes, and I'm looking forward to diving into this conversation because I feel like it is kind of one of the littler knowns out of the dyscalculia, dysgraphia, dyslexia. And so having your insight will be very powerful for our listeners. So before I kind of start asking you some questions, I like to ask my guests something that's like a little known fact about you, a fun fact that you would like to share. Is there anything that people may not realize about you when it comes, besides just your knowledge and experience with working with students?
Well, apart from my interest in dyscalculia, I also love Pomeranians, and I have two little tiny Pomeranian dogs, which are my babies, to be honest.
Oh, and what are their names?
Bella and Bessie.
Fantastic. And I am sure they are snuggling up to you and loving all this work that you're doing.
Yeah, one of them's on my lap right now.
Excellent. All right. So can you help us understand what dyscalculia is? How do you define it?
Well, I think the simplest definition is to say that it's a specific and persistent difficulty in understanding numbers, which can lead to a range of difficulties with maths. And it's important to understand that it can occur across all age ranges, levels of education and ability. So it's not something that suggests somebody has a lower ability or a higher ability. It can occur over any ability. And it also can occur singly, but it also can occur with another condition. We often say it comes with a friend. So something like dyslexia or ADHD or dyspraxia and so on.
So what are some main barriers in a student's life with dyscalculia?
Well, I think the obvious one at school level is obviously the maths lessons themselves. That's going to have a big impact, but it affects confidence because of the difficulties with maths. And it also shows itself in other subjects, things like science, geography, PE. You don't really think about how much maths is involved in PE, but direction and timing of events, all of these things are really impactful on maths. And in life as a whole, maths is all around us all of the time. And one of the biggest skills we use as people, both as children and adults, is a constant sense of estimation. We're constantly estimating and making judgments on that. And dyscalculics don't have that ability. So that makes things like time, time durations, dealing with money, measures, and everyday things like baking, shopping, really, really tricky as well.
So how do you kind of learn some characteristics, or how do we pick up on some characteristics of students with dyscalculia?
Well, there's a very wide range of characteristics
of
with dyscalculia. It's not like a small group of things, but some of the main characteristics are that they struggle with something called subitizing, which means recognizing a small number of objects without counting. And if you think of a mother duck going across the road with her little baby ducklings all along behind her, she will turn round, she will see if the ducklings are all there, and she will make a judgment. She'll make an estimation. Oh yes, my ducklings are all there. And that ability is in nature to subitize, and dyscalculics don't have that. They don't have that innate ability to recognize a small number of objects without having to individually count them. And that affects things as simple for an adult with dyscalculia as knowing how much food to put on a plate, because how do you judge how much something is that's the right amount? So estimation, as I mentioned earlier, difficulties with ordering and sequencing, and often directionality as well, which could come with dyslexia too. Recognizing and understanding symbols to do with maths, how numbers relate to each other, and how their representations relate to each other. Learning and recalling basic maths facts and procedures, things like number bonds, times tables, people often mention, and applying number skills to solve problems. So problem solving can be very tricky. And also this impacts both their short term, their work and their working memory. So dyscalculics often have difficulty holding information in their head and then being able to store it and use it. And as I said, that affects lots of everyday tasks to do with money and time as well.
Yeah, and as you're kind of sharing this, I'm thinking about a lot of overlap with some executive function skills, right? Like if we're talking about planning, or we're talking about estimating, or kind of just working memory and so forth. Can you share any further kind of information about that with dyscalculia and executive function, and how do we
it's very
determine them both?
Yeah, it's very complicated, because obviously, you know, when we put somebody forward, a child or an adult, for an assessment, and we're trying to unpick what part of their profile is to do with their executive functioning, their memory and so on, and which part of it is to do with dyscalculia, it's very complicated. So I think that from a teaching and learning point of view, we have to think about how the characteristics of somebody with dyscalculia impact them, and how we can best work with that, because people might struggle with maths but not necessarily be dyscalculic too. So I think it's a very complicated package.
Yeah, and I find that in the world of special education and really individualizing that support for students, that it's complex in the sense that every student is very different, and really trying to understand those gaps and gains within a learning profile for a student. So how do we effectively identify dyscalculia in students?
So in the UK, because obviously I'm based in the UK, so it might be slightly different. So in the UK, in order to assess a child and diagnose them with dyscalculia, that has to be done by either an educational psychologist or a level 7 dyscalculia assessor. So that's somebody with a specific qualification in assessing for dyscalculia. Quite often in the UK, we also have those for dyslexia as well. So it's a level 7 assessor. So they would be the people who would make the judgment as to whether somebody has a diagnosis or not. If we're talking about in a classroom, how would we spot it and work with it? On the Dyscalculia Network, which is the site that I run, we have a checklist, which is a great start for teachers to look at, or even parents or an adult with dyscalculia to look at and say, oh, does some of these characteristics, maybe the characteristics I've mentioned earlier, some of those identifying factors, do they relate to me? Or do they relate to my student? Because what we want to do is we want to start gathering evidence of what is happening with this student, with this person. And a checklist is a really good place to start, as well as obviously the informal observations of teachers and parents and carers.
Yeah, and that's incredibly important. And then I also see that just when I teach a course for families here in the United States on getting an IEP, the second part of that is the evidence, right? Collecting the evidence of how this impacts the student educationally, but then also in their daily life. So I think it's really important for us. And I actually just recorded a solo episode about SMART goals for individualized education program IEPs for students. And just really starting with that evidence can build a pathway forward to ensure that everybody that's on board with that student is understanding again, those gaps and gains, and then the measures are put into place to really support them learning and then teach them how to learn and learn those strategies so that eventually they can individually implement them throughout their day. You mentioned a little bit about comorbidity, like dyscalculia has a friend. Can you just share a little bit more about kind of what that means and how everything is teased out if we're looking for a diagnosis?
Yeah, so I think that we see dyscalculia and a lot of neurodiversities or specific learning difficulties coming with another learning need. It's very common for there to be overlap with dyslexia. It's very common for there to be some overlap with ADHD and with dyspraxia, for example. Several adults on our adult advisory board have one or more of these neurodiversities as well as dyscalculia. And there isn't much research to show the links between these different neurodiversities. Dyscalculia is very under-researched. It's probably about 30 years behind the research for dyslexia. So there's a long way to go to find out how these link together. And one of the things that we do with the Dyscalculia Network is to link up with the other organisations who work together. So we work with an organisation called the National Neurodiversity Youth Council, which is all about youths, young people from 16 to 25, talking about their neurodiversities. And that project is really important because we need to start seeing how these overlap and the implications on young adults and as they move forward into adulthood.
So kind of let's move into how do we actually support our students with dyscalculia, right? So we kind of talked about that there's a high probability of a comorbidity and that identifying a student is helpful in terms of, at least in the States, getting services. But in best practice as educators and even families and professionals, how can we actually support our students that are identified with dyscalculia?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, obviously, we do want to look for getting support as early as possible. So our current knowledge and understanding is we need to assess children, not necessarily for do you have dyscalculia or not, but where are they in their maths learning?
Yeah.
And this is the bit that obviously is often missed. It's, oh, yes, the learner has a diagnosis of dyscalculia. Then what? And we always say that the diagnosis is not worth anything if it's nothing's going to happen with it. So we need to use effective assessment to identify gaps. So we need to find what's happening in the learner, because maths is a bit like a game of Jenga. Do you have this game, Jenga?
Yes.
So Jenga, where you build up the little blocks into a tower. And to have a good maths tower, you need to have all those blocks built up neatly, one on top of the other. And they all develop on top of each other. When you can do number bonds of 10, then you learn number bonds to 10, and then you learn your bridging skills and so on, doubles, halves, and it builds up. And often with our dyscalculic learners, they've got big gaps in this knowledge and understanding, especially as they get older and they haven't been identified. So we really must work to identify those gaps, first of all, actually find out where the student is actually at with their understanding, not what we think they're at, but actually what do they know. And then we need to begin our intervention just before that level of breakdown. So we don't want to be afraid to peel right back and find out what they know, because if we don't do that, they're never going to make progress. And that's a really hard thing. When I teach full-time as well, and when you have a student who's maybe much older, maybe not 7 or 8, maybe 15 or 16 or an adult, and you say, we need to go right back to the beginning of maths. We need to look at place value. We look at number bonds. That's incredibly difficult, both for the learner and the parent and everybody working with the child to think that. So if any opportunity we get to go back and really build that foundation from the beginning, that is what usually is missing. And usually individual education plans have been created around targets that are at age appropriate levels. And the problem is not at age appropriate. The problem is way beyond that, under that. So we need we need to go right in underneath and find out, go back far enough. So that's kind of my two most important things. And then I would say, obviously, the best way to work with people with dyscalculia is to use what we call the concrete, pictorial, visualize, verbalize abstract approach. Now, I always add in these two words. You hear about CPA, concrete, pictorial, abstract, all the time. It's multi-sensory teaching. It's a must for dyscalculic learners because very often dyscalculic learners, and we haven't talked about the strengths of dyscalculic learners, but often dyscalculic learners have a strength in their ability to build, to have a good visual picture of things, and often they're very creative thinkers. So we can build on that. Now, not everybody is the same because, you know, no human is the same. So, of course, every dyscalculic learner is the same. But generally speaking, the multisensory approach really works brilliantly for dyscalculics. And we want to put in the visualize and verbalize as well as the concrete and the pictorial. So we want to start with a multisensory resource. Then we want to link that to pictures of the multisensory resource. And we want to visualize. And this is really important because dyscalculics don't have that sense in their head of what it looks like. So we really want to encourage them to visualize, what does this look like? You know, if they're building a number with Dean's blocks, what does this look like? How does that look in my head if I close my eyes? And we want to verbalize. And this is absolutely key, both as educators and for our learners. We need to model good maths talk. And if we can model good maths talk, it always makes me smile when I've said something a certain way. You know, I've said, I know that 7 plus 6 is 13 because I know that 6 add 6 is 12. So 6 add 7 is 1 more than that. So it must be 13. And a few lessons later, I hear my pupil get that question and repeat it back. They're like, oh, I know this because, yeah. So this is really important, this talking about maths. And moving to the abstract is really difficult for dyscalculic learners. So this concrete, pictorial, visualize, verbalize, is we're doing all of these things and gradually moving towards the abstract. So we're using our concrete manipulatives, but writing the questions underneath. We're using the symbols that they struggle with, using the numerical version. So that is really, really important. And by doing that, that's how we can scaffold learning. And we need to make sure that everything we're doing, we are doing revising pre-skills that they need or that they haven't yet got. We need to teach concepts in small, very progressive steps and then move very slowly towards them having good understanding. Because we're not working on rote learning, we're working on building conceptual understanding of maths, because that is what is going to stay in people's head. People say to me, oh, my child doesn't remember anything that they've done. And it's because they're relying on their short-term memory and nothing is going into their long-term memory. So we have to really work hard for that.
So much good information here that light bulbs were going off. I love the concept of Jenga in terms of learners. And, you know, my big focus on my side is reading interventions. And so I can really see how and how that aligns. And just even with families that I work with and speak with, talking about doing an assessment where we can really break down these pockets of vulnerability to see what's going on. And now I'm going to use that analogy of Jenga, because you can really see the holes when you pull out a block, and then is it shaky? And it really then makes sense. And you're absolutely right in terms of maths and reading and building that skill set of where the breakdown occurs so that you can then move forward. And 100%, I know our older students think, oh, I don't really want to go back. But oftentimes in the school, the curriculum moves so quickly that if you don't pick up on those foundations, then just like Jenga, it's a little bit rocky for sure. And I think that's an excellent analogy for all of us to be able to visualize what that could look like for a student.
And we get that maths anxiety when we feel wobbly. So when we don't have a firm basis of what we're doing, when we don't feel sure in what we're doing, that's when we have anxiety. And maths anxiety obviously can happen to any learner, whether they're very good at maths or really struggling with maths. But it really hits home when you think of not having that firm foundation, and then people keep giving you more and more information on top of that, and you're never going to feel secure. You're never going to have a solid tower. You're always going to feel worried. Really have to think about mental health of people, of young people too. This is really important.
I'm glad you brought that up, because there is so much anxiety around school for students, and to, you know, because I think students then start to compare themselves to their classmates, and then they see this student or that student excelling and things that they may internally feel they should know. And then it really becomes this snowball. And you're right, then it does impact your, you know, how you feel and how you interact with the world and how you interact with school. And that's a whole element that people don't discuss as much.
No, and it's very common when you talk to adults with dyscalculia that they mention masking. So masking means that they cover up their difficulty, either within their social situation, within friends, and even sometimes with family, but also more that they cover it up in the workplace. And that is really common, and it's very detrimental to mental health to be constantly masking your difficulties. So it's why it's so important that we reduce anxiety early and we give people the tools in which to not only know the maths, but also advocate for themselves and find their own workarounds and give them the opportunities to do that. Because at the end of the day, they're going to live with dyscalculia forever. It's not something that you can grow out of. It's a specific learning difficulty that's going to impact somebody for their whole life. So it's really, really important to make sure we really think about what will be beneficial in the long term, not just the now.
Yes, and then helping students with that transition, right, in terms, well, back to the masking, that's exhausting, right? So if you're spending your day masking, by the time you get home, as a student, as a child, you're exhausted. And so then there's that element in how you interact with your family when you're feeling exhausted, but then also in supporting our students with transition. So helping them identify where their skill sets are so that as they become adults and become independent learners and have their own jobs, that they're able to navigate that with a sense of confidence.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's things, again, we can do to make that easier. So not only can we start at the place where they're stuck and give them that multi-sensory approach, but we need to give them lots of opportunity for practice. Repetition and overlearning is really, really key, and we can't move on too fast. And it's really tempting as educators to look at targets and the next thing they've got to do and the next thing they've got to achieve. But with children with dyscalculia, we need to take that time. We need to circle back and revisit things and just kind of, I think of it as like a cyclical approach. You go round, you do something, and then you go to the next level. But all the time you keep checking back on the stuff that's gone before, because you need to make sure we don't drop anything out. A brick can get wobbly very easily for a dyscalculic. So we need to make sure we keep filling them back in and giving them a little cement around the edges and pop them back in just to make that difference. And also we can do little things in the classroom, particularly, well, for adults too, but particularly in the classroom, like avoiding timed activities and timed tests. Putting time pressure on somebody who's already feeling anxious, lots of research into anxiety that we don't need to go into, but we know that anxiety massively impacts working memory. So if you're already struggling with working memory and then you add anxiety because you've got a timed limit on it, on something, then that is really, really negative experience. And often timed tests are unnecessary. We want to know actually what somebody knows, not necessarily how quickly they can do it. I mean, the best mathematicians in the world spend years working on one problem, and nobody says they should be going faster. We need to take time to do things and just go slowly. And the other thing I think is really important is we need to teach vocabulary very specifically to dyscalculics in the context of things they're interested in. Always helps, especially for teenagers. But math vocabulary doesn't come easy to dyscalculics, and there's so much math vocabulary that is specific to maths, as well as general words like after and before that can be confused, especially with younger learners. So we have to really teach that explicit vocabulary. I think that's another important point. And also play lots of games, because maths is supposed to be fun. You know, those of us who enjoy maths think it should be fun. So that's another thing we can do to reduce anxiety, providing the game is at the right level.
Can we just talk a little bit about multisensory and what does that look like in terms of the concrete to pictorial when we're starting a concept with our students? Like, okay. What are some examples of that?
Yeah, so let's think of something like place value. Let's just think of really early place value, like understanding tens and ones, and understanding that 10 ones make a 10 and 10 tens make 100, and that the number 47 is 4 tens and 7 ones, this kind of early concept. So we would start with base 10 materials. We call them Dean's blocks, but I don't know whether that's the same base 10.
10.
So hundreds, tens and ones. So I would start with building those numbers on a place value grid, for example, so on a hundreds, tens and ones grid, maybe building teens numbers because they're always tricky. So I'd start with building teens numbers, talking about what number we've built. The child would be doing lots of building, but to start linking it to the abstract, I would also be writing. I usually do my hundred, tens and ones grid on a laminated sheet so that we can write on it with a whiteboard pen or on a whiteboard. So we want to maybe be writing underneath what numbers we're building. And then at the same time as that, we can either use stamps of base 10. You can get these cool little stamps if you're working one-to-one, or you start getting the child to draw pictures of what they're doing. So it's very easy to draw a little stick to represent a 10 and some little squares, or if the child struggles with that, little dots to represent ones. And you can start saying, oh, well, if you build me this number, 34, for example, could you also draw me what 34 looks like to you from that picture? Also, this is great for seeing whether they can draw, like they can see that tens are the same size, that ones should be of similar-ish size. So you can, all kinds of other informal assessment can go on there. And then when children are drawing things for themselves, that's helping them to process that it's the same thing when they see it visually as it is when they see it in the, hold it in their hands. And they need to hold it in their hands first. But then if we can move them to that picture, and then in the picture you say, can you write me underneath what you've shown? And automatically you've connected three things really easily, and bringing those three things all together whilst talking about it, and also saying, can you imagine that in your head? Close your eyes. Can you see the picture of that? That's hugely beneficial.
So what are some recommendations for classroom teachers that have a larger group of students in terms of implementing best practice strategies and implementing multi-sensory, but then our educators feel pressure to have to keep moving through the curriculum that they're required to get through? So how do we kind of create that balance?
I think the balance is very difficult to create for educators, because I don't know how big your class sizes here in the US are, but here the class sizes can be up to 32, 34. So you've got very big class sizes. Often you haven't got a teaching assistant in the classroom. Sometimes you're lucky and you do. And this is a very real issue. And one of the things that we are campaigning for in the UK is more awareness in general about dyscalculia, because it's vastly under known about, full stop. A lot of people don't know about the word dyscalculia. I tell everybody about it, hairdressers, people in queues, in the shops. What do you do? Oh yes. It's really important to talk about it. But we need people higher up in government, people in county level, to realize that there's children who aren't being helped because teachers are willing. They are often willing to do the extra work to help children. But like you say, in a classroom situation with a lot of children working at different curriculum levels, it can be very challenging. But certainly using the concrete resources is something that every classroom should have, no matter what the age of a child. And I don't know whether you see this, but we see this here, is that we see manipulatives in 7, 8, 9-year-olds in their classrooms, and all of a sudden they disappear as if poof, in a puff of smoke. And dyscalculics need these manipulatives through their whole school career. They need to be able to see it and hold it. So that's something that's really easy to do in a classroom setting, is to make sure all children have access to manipulatives, because nobody needs to be singled out for that. Everybody should have resources. And also just differentiating that work, giving things like a worksheet that's got a smaller number of questions per page is hugely beneficial for reducing maths anxiety, taking away that timed pressure. Again, little things can make a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I can see where, you know, as parents with our kids when they're younger and really using those manipulatives, and I'm glad you brought up the part in terms of when our students get older in a classroom, they do disappear. Is there a certain intervention program that people can follow, or is it really just taking a look at the concept and really tackling it through that multi-sensory lens?
Well, I think there are different programs out there available because, of course, there are, I was trained by somebody called Dorian Yeo back in 2003. So this is actually my 21st year of teaching in a certain way. And there's a great book by Jane Emerson and Patricia Babtie called The Dyscalculia Solution, which has a really good multi-sensory step-by-step kind of guide to how to teach. And I actually, and I'm going to give a plug for my own books here because that's why I'm here. I've actually worked with Professor Steve Chin, who's created a lot of books around dyscalculia. We're actually mid-series of a new set of books called Succeed with Dyscalculia, which are a set of books which are worksheets with teaching tips for teachers, because the thing that we felt was missing is that teachers, like you say, they want to do something, but they've lots of children working at lots of different levels, and they don't necessarily have the time to create materials that are specific for children with dyscalculia. So these books are worksheets, and they're actually suitable for any age learner. So they're just as suitable for a teenager or an adult who needs to use these skills as they are for a young child, because there's no little bunnies or ladybirds flying around the page or anything condescending in them at all. But they're set out in a very simple way, because what we found with the worksheets, and I've worked in schools for years, is that there's a lot of concepts on one page, a lot of different problems and a lot of different concepts. And dyscalculic learners need to take things slowly, and they need one thing at a time, right down to those little baby split up steps of the difference between just adding one to a two-digit number. Taking one from a two-digit number is a whole nother skill set. And often on a worksheet that a class teacher will have, it will have add one, take one, add 10, take 10, add 100, take 100. And that's like 12 weeks of work for a dyscalculic. So these worksheets break it down very, very simply. And there's lots of computer programs out there as well, various different ones, which are good for number sense, building number sense too.
Do you have any recommendations that for parents or professionals to consider when they are creating goals or ways to support a student through an IEP?
Yeah, and I think these can be broken down into two kind of categories. There's the maths targets, and then there's the how they're going to be supported targets, if that makes sense. So to me, this is just an example. Let's just say this is a recent set of targets that one of my own pupils, because I teach privately, one of my own pupils, I worked with somebody else to create her maths targets that are going to be applicable both in her lessons with me and also in her school situation. So she has dyscalculia. She's also dyslexic. So her targets, she's already worked with me for about a year, but her targets are to continue to reinforce and practice number bonds and combinations for 10, to reinforce counting on and back in ones for two digit, progressing to three digit numbers, and to work on reinforcing place value for three digit numbers, reading and writing numbers, comparing and so on. Gaining familiarity with coins and how these relate to place value. Money is very important. And beginning to link doubles and double subtraction to the two times table and division facts, and developing maths vocabulary. So they're very specific maths targets. So I personally believe that children's individual education plan should be made up of those type of targets, which are very specific to the learner, so that we can track progress. How are they doing on these very specific targets that we're working towards? But then we need to have targets of how we're going to do that. So we have to have support targets. So in this case, this little girl, we have differentiated work in the classroom is a target for the class, for the teacher. Adapting the CPVVA approach in the classroom. So she's got to have concrete manipulatives, but particularly for her, she's got to be encouraged to draw representations herself because that works really well for her. So that's a particular target. She's got to have scaffolding in place in class so that she's not left on her own to panic. She's got to be given more time, and she's got exam access arrangements for more time as well. And she needs worksheets with a small number of questions on the page. So ideally, not more than 10 at one go, because that's really overwhelming for her when she's got more questions. And also, she's encouraged to use bar modelling, which works for her as well. And she's also got been asked to create her own maths dictionary to work on the maths bank. So it's a combination. And I think IEPs just need to be that. They need to be a combination of good strategy. These are good strategies for this learner that work over time. We can find this works and this works. And something like a maths dictionary can be on the learner's profile, IEP, for their whole maths career, but then very specific maths related targets.
And absolutely, that kind of even circles back to your Jenga analogy and just really kind of assessing all the elements for that student so that when you go to create those SMART goals in the IEP, you really have that focus, and they're not just generalized goals. They are very individualized for that student's needs. So it's a great way to think about that when, as a parent, if you're going to write your parent input statement of your concerns, or as an educator, as you're developing those goals. What are some barriers that you have seen that can kind of get in the way of that effective support for students?
I think that the number one barrier is the fact that there's not enough support in the classroom. Because, you know, if you don't have another adult in the classroom with you and you've got a group of children who are really struggling, that is really difficult. That is a big barrier to learning. I think that anxiety becomes a huge barrier to learning, and especially as children get older into teenage years and they've basically just pulled back from wanting to learn. Because let's face it, all of us, if we constantly feel like we're failing at something, we don't really want to do it anymore, do we? We're like, oh, let's move on from this. This isn't for me. Like, clearly, you know, I was never going to be a sprinter. So, you know, I've moved on from sprinting as a choice of exercise to something more gentle. So, you know, but they can't move away from maths. So that's really, really important, is that we acknowledge those things. And I think that often another barrier is going too fast. Things have just gone too fast, and that really impacts learners.
What are some ways that we can get the entire team on board with working with students, meaning the parents generally, yes, but just the professionals, the folks that are sitting at an IEP table, the educators? How can we kind of get everybody on board?
Well, I think it's having time to do that, because first of all, we need to make there be time for those people to meet in one room and discuss it. And most of all, to hear the child, because what we are not doing well, and we are really trying to change that, the dyscalculia network, is we're not listening to the voices of the people with the neurodiversity. And the dyscalculic learner knows themselves pretty well, and they know what they're struggling with, and we need to be there to support them in that. So I think the key is to have the child, not in all the conversations, but to have that teamwork, give time to it, and really listen to what the anxiety of the parents are. And that involves senior leadership being on board. And I think that's I always say to school, if you've got senior leadership on board for the fact that you need to differentiate, that the child is not going to reach the age expected targets, and that's okay. If that child is making progress on what they started from and what they know now, that is what is key. But that takes change on a greater level in the classroom.
Yeah, but you can see where there's just so many parallels. And, you know, I know our conversation today is focusing on dyscalculia, but you can see where this transfers over to many situations and students with a variety of learning needs and differences.
Yeah,
so you cool. have mentioned several accommodations that can work and support for a student. Is there ones that we could use at home or socially? Because you had originally had mentioned that, you know, dyscalculia can impact a student or a individual in a social situation as well. So what are some things that we could support a student with at home or in a social setting with dyscalculia?
Yeah, and that's a really good. First of all, I think that if it's we're talking about a parent, so let's think about a parent specifically. So first of all, liaise with your child's school. That is absolutely key. If you can get a good communication and relationship with your child's school, that is a really good starting point. We need to ask the school what you can do to help at home, because often parents are shy to come forward and say, how can I help? Or the parent does something different at home to what's going on at school. And if we can all talk from the same hymn sheet or sing from the same hymn sheet, that's going to be really beneficial. And if parents can practice little and often, at home, that is really brilliant. And homework shouldn't be something that's done on Sunday night in an hour of total stress when everybody's exhausted, everyone's had a busy weekend, nobody wants to think about maths homework. It should be a little bit every day, just 5 minutes, 10 minutes here and there. So we really need to think about that with parents. It's a great thing you can do at home is say to school, right, what can I do every day to practice? Not rote learning, I point out. You can get those same hands-on manipulatives at home, the same ones that are being used at school, ideally. That's a brilliant thing parents can do if that's something that's within their capability financially. Kind of the biggest one, and this one often is really difficult to get across to parents, but you need to talk about maths positively at home. Because your enthusiasm as a role model will rub off on your child. If you're always saying, wow, look at this, you know, that number's really interesting, and look at the shape of that. That is going to bring maths into your child's life. If you're constantly saying, oh, I was never going good at maths either, and oh yeah, no, maths is really hard, that is not going to help your child to feel more positive about math. So we have to really think about being a role model for children as a positive thing. And also talk about maths at home. Talk about maths when you're doing your baking, when you're doing DIY, when you're doing your craft, or you're at the supermarket. Often we don't talk with our children maybe as much as we should about everyday things, especially now we just swipe cards everywhere. We don't really talk about how much we're spending or how much things cost or how that is relative to money. So I think talking about what we can do is really important. And on that topic, this is one of my little personal projects, which is give your child, young person, pocket money in cash. However they earn their pocket money, by doing chores, whatever it is, give them cash, because they have to understand coins and notes, and they need to have money boxes for spending and saving. Because if we want children to have good budgeting skills later, and dyscalculic adults tell me that their biggest problem is with budgeting, they don't understand money well enough to budget. So if we've got children and we can do anything we can to start to get them to understand value, which is a really hard concept for a dyscalculic, that's going to be amazing. And also, we always say the power of yet, and this applies to teachers as well. When they say they can't do it, they don't understand it, when they're doing their homework and they're having a meltdown, make sure that you say, you can't do it yet. You don't understand it yet. Because that's really, really key. And also be praise all the little bits that they do right. You know, because if we hear praise, we think we're good at something. You know, we're like, oh, I did well. Because if people say, oh, that's really good, that's really good, oh, that was brilliant, it makes you feel better about yourself. And sometimes we forget that with children who are struggling, that they probably heard less praise. So giving them that praise at home is a really good way to boost confidence.
What suggestions do you have if a student is not receptive to some teaching strategies?
Well, in my experience, you can get any child to be, or any young person to be receptive, if you are kind and empathetic and give them the encouragement and the support and don't put them under pressure. I'll give you an example. I started working one-to-one with a child who was completely, he's 10, he was completely broken down as far as maths was concerned. He's also ADHD, so there's a lot of other things going on. But he was completely broken down according to maths. And it was no exaggeration to say that he was dragged into my classroom crying and spent most of the first lesson on the floor. But I accepted that. I didn't try to push him out of his comfort zone. That is where he felt how he was engaged at that point. And somebody else might have gone, you're not, you know, that you can't work with this child. Like, you can't. But you just have to get into the level of where that child is, how they are feeling. And if you've ever felt any anxiety, and unfortunately I'm somebody who does suffer from anxiety, but it's fortunate in one way because it means I understand how it feels. If you feel anxiety, you shut down, and it's very difficult for people to get to you and get past that anxiety. So we have to be really encouraging and supportive, and that power of yet is really key. And also making sure we're doing something that's just before the level they got stuck. So if we can do something that's just within their capabilities and make that a fun thing, with this child it was games, just within his reach. And we just worked on those games for weeks. And it took me about 3 months to get him sat with me for 50 minutes, doing a whole lesson, totally engaged with me. And sometimes it takes a bit of time, but that's down to you as an educator, as a parent. That's not down to the child.
Yeah, and that's such a true thing, right? In terms of finding that sweet spot, right? Of where a student is capable and then pushing them forward, but not pushing them over the edge, right? Finding that little sweet spot for them to feel confidence, see success, start to grow, but not overdo it.
Exactly. And I always think if the child isn't engaging, it's not the child who's the problem. Like, the child isn't the problem. The child is responding to a lifetime of feeling like they're not understood and that they can't do it. And you've got to bring that round. And sometimes that takes some time. Sometimes it's not quick. And sometimes it's frustrating. You know, there was days in those 3 months when I was like, oh, come on, we can do this. And then you get to that child working with you and you're like, okay, their child was there underneath it.
Yeah, just pull back those layers. Can we talk a little bit about retention versus memorization and the importance?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something, again, that I'm really, really passionate about, the difference between repetition for the point of just memorization and conceptual understanding. So, maths understanding and conceptual understanding is not built on rote learning. Rote learning is rarely, if ever, I think in the whole of my last 20 years, I've only come across two or three children for which rote learning was a part of their capability as a dyscalculic. So that's a lot of children over 20 years, I think. I've never actually counted, but yeah. When we have a learner who is struggling like that, we need to make sure that we don't rely on memory because memory will fail them. It won't go into their long-term memory. We have to work on this conceptual understanding. And as we build conceptual understanding, what we see as we're working through our program, so say I'm working with a child on number bonds of 10 to start with, which is, you know, a good place to start. We're working on number bonds of 10, then we'll start working on breaking down the component parts of other numbers to 10. So breaking down 9 into 6 and 3, 7 into 4 and 3, and so on. You might say, well, how do I know if they've kept that? But the next thing I'm going to do is bridging 10. And I'm going to look at 9 add 4. Well, unless they understand that 9 is 1 less than 10, or that 9 add 1 is 10, and then they can split their 4 into a 1 and a 3, they're not going to be able to do that. So I can very easily see whether they're retaining their previous knowledge. And it's not based on their memory, it's based on their conceptual understanding of how numbers. And I think Steve Chin, who I work with on the books, says combinations of numbers, those early number bonds, are like the phonics of maths. And I think that's a really good way of looking at it, that it's not memory of knowing them, it's understanding what they are, how they work, how they combine, and how they separate and recombine.
You had mentioned when we first started chatting about dyscalculia and that we learn strategies, but it doesn't go away. How do you have that conversation with either a parent or a student so that they kind of understand who they are and then understand kind of any barriers that may come with independence and independent living?
I think it depends on the age of the learner, first of all. So for a very young child, there's a great book called Gary and Maths, which is a very simple picture book written by the lovely Bridget Mather Scott and her son, who actually has some learning differences himself, and he illustrated the book, and he wrote it about his experience. And I would always, when I'm talking to a young child, like a recently diagnosed child, I always start with, this is some of the things that are going to impact you. We read the story, we talk about it, and then we talk about what your strengths are in relation to that, because we really need to think about individual strengths. That's really important for learners with dyscalculia or any specific learning difficulty or neurodiversity, is to know that, yes, there's things that impact you on a daily basis, but there's also things that are going to bring you great strength and great joy in your career and your life. So first of all, I think that's really important for younger learners. As learners get older, I think it's really important to give them support to use technology, support to understand themselves as learners, to encourage them to talk about how they're feeling. And again, you need that supportive environment, somebody, a trusted person that they can talk to. And for adults, what I'm finding more and more, and running the Dyscalculia Network, honestly, has been the best experience, because I have learned so much, because I'm just a person without dyscalculia. And I talk about dyscalculia not because I'm some expert in dyscalculia, but I'm trying to get the voice of dyscalculics out there. And by talking to adults, the thing that they most need to do is talk to other people who feel the same as them. And the thing that's currently missing in many schools, in many walks of life, is that they don't have somebody else who's the same. So many adults who I hear say, I've never met somebody else with dyscalculia, or children say, there's nobody else in my class who's got dyscalculia. And making connections, human connections, is really important for adults to just have that, oh yeah, I'm like that. Oh yeah, I struggled with learning to drive too. Oh my goodness, yeah, meetings and scheduling. Oh, I still don't understand the 24 o'clock. And those conversations between adults is a huge support.
Beautifully said. And then kind of as we're winding down, for parents that are listening and they're saying, oh my gosh, that's my kiddo. When they're trying to find somebody to help support their student outside of the school setting, what are some questions that they should ask? Like if they say, you know, I just need a math tutor, is very different than somebody that has the understanding that we're talking about today.
Yeah. Now, obviously, in the UK, I don't know how it works in the US, so I'm a little bit talking about what happens here. So in the UK, then we have what's called a level 5 qualified dyscalculia assessor, dyscalculia tutor, who is somebody who's got a qualification to teach children with dyscalculia. And that is key, because as we've just said, it's slightly different and you need to go about things not in a different way, because maths is maths, but you do need to have certain qualities and think about things in a certain way. And training is certainly important. Before I trained, I didn't know what to do. I will be totally honest. You know, you learn as you go. So here, that's the case. And I certainly think that parents need to make sure that somebody, even if they don't have training, if they're willing to learn, that is really key, because you will come across some maths tutors like, well, it's my way or no way. And you do need people who are prepared to go, well, let me research this. If I haven't got training, where can I get some support? Where can I get some help? And I'm sure you can guide people to what's available in the US, the same as I can here. But also, obviously, do have a look at our Dyscalculia Network. We actually have a brand new website. It's very exciting. We have a brand new website launching, hopefully, at the beginning of March, bear with us. And there'll be lots of information on there that parents can take, like checklists, like information, tips to do at home, all of those things.
What is a question that I did not ask, that I didn't know enough to ask, that I should have asked?
Well, something you didn't ask was how common is dyscalculia?
Yes.
So dyscalculia is thought to be, and again, research is a little bit behind, so this is what we think at the moment, thought to be around 6%. So I know that for the UK, that figure works out to be about 4 million people in the UK with dyscalculia. So I did a quick calculation earlier today because I wondered how that worked for the US. So apparently, now I'm relying on Google here, guys, so, you know, bear with. Apparently the population of the US is approximately 341 million. Tell me it. You know, apparently, according to that, means there's about 20.5 million people in the US with dyscalculia. And that's not people with math difficulties, because the research shows that math difficulties in general is between 20 and 25% of the population. But very specifically, dyscalculia, you're talking about over 20 million people. So we're not talking about something that's a small issue. We're talking about something that's on par with other things like dyslexia, and that isn't yet being given the bandwidth that it deserves.
Yes. And I think the one statistic that I've seen that I speak about 1 in 5 in a classroom have some type of learning difference that has been identified, and that's identified. So if you think about 1 in 5, but then you think about the students that haven't been identified that are struggling. So I'm glad we're bringing attention to this, and I'm certainly will put the links in the show notes so that people can find you and find more about the network and to be able to get some resources so that they can support their students as well.
Yeah, I just would say we've got a really big event coming up, and I don't know when you're going to publish this, but hopefully before it. We have Dyscalculia Day. World Dyscalculia Day is on the 3rd of March. It was set up, a guy whose name escapes me, who set it up to be the 3rd of the 3rd, because it was a nice easy date for dyscalculics, which I really appreciate the thought process. And we have taken this on because nothing had really come of it. So we actually have an amazing set of conferences in the few weeks around the 3rd of March. They're not all on the same day because it's a Sunday, annoyingly, this year. But we have a conference for parents. It's online, so all of you guys from the US are welcome to sign up. The links are all on our website to sign up, and we can send you a recording afterwards. But we have one for parents, one for educators, and one for adults, which is a really good opportunity to adults to learn more about dyscalculia and talk to other adults. And that always ends up being a very long conversation at the end of that one, and a lot of chatting. But we also have a free assemblies for, well, what we call primary and secondary. I don't know how that relates, but we have free assemblies on with dyscalculia awareness, with videos of children talking about it too, which are brilliant for schools to use and downloads. So there's a lot going on there. And if anyone happens to be in the UK in March, we also have the world's first in-person dyscalculia show at a conference centre in Birmingham, UK.
I would love to take a trip.
Yes. Come over. Hello.
I would love a trip. If you had, my final question I ask my guest, if you had one tip for parents that we could put on a billboard, what would it be and why?
Oh my goodness, what would it be? I think that it would be, your child will be incredible and have an amazing life, whether or not they can do maths or not.
Beautiful.
I think it's really key for thinking about that.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, thank you so much for this enlightening conversation. And I can't wait to get this out for everybody to hear and to learn more about you and learn more about supporting students with dyscalculia. So thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Thank you for tuning in to this enlightening episode of the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I hope you have gained valuable insight into the world of dyscalculia and the power of empathy, support, and collaboration in empowering individuals on their neurodiversity journey. Don't forget to check out the Dyscalculia Network and connect with Pat Edel to learn more about their invaluable resources and support services. Together, let's continue unmasking dyscalculia and fostering a world where unique learning journeys shine bright. Be sure to subscribe for more episodes and join us next time as we continue to explore topics related to special education and parent advocacy. Until then, take care and keep advocating for your students' success. Remember, empowerment begins with understanding. Keep the conversation going and let's create a more inclusive, supportive community for all. Until next time, this is Wendy Taylor. Take care, keep advocating for every student's right to thrive. Bye for now.